Side 8.
Bursar! I shouldn't have to run around like this at my age, thought the bursar, scurrying down the corridor in answer to the Arch-Chancellor's bellow. Why is he so interested in the damn thing anyway, wretched pot? Coming, master, he trilled.
The Arch-Chancellor's desk was covered with ancient documents. When a wizard died, all his papers were stored in one of the outlying reaches of the library. Shelf after shelf of quietly mouldering documents, the haunt of mysterious beetles and dry rot, stretched away into an unguessable distance. Everyone kept telling everyone that there was a wealth of material here for researchers, if only someone could find the time to do it. The bursar was annoyed. He couldn't find the librarian anywhere. The ape never seemed to be around these days. He'd had to scrabble among the stuff himself.
"I think this is the last, Arch-Chancellor," he said, tipping an avalanche of dusty paperwork onto the desk.
Ridcully flailed at a cloud of moths.
"Paper, paper, paper," he muttered. "How many damn bits of paper in his stuff,
23,813, Arch-Chancellor," said the bursar. "He kept a record."
"Look at this," said the Arch-Chancellor. "Star enumerator. Rev counter for use in ecclesiastical areas. Swamp meter. Swamp meter!" The man was mad.
"He had a very tidy mind," said the bursar.
"Same thing."
"Is it, really important, Arch-Chancellor?" the bursar ventured.
"Damn thing shot pellets at me," said Ridcully. "Twice."
"I'm sure it wasn't, intended. I want to see how it was made, man. Just think of the sportin' possibilities."
The bursar tried to think of the possibilities.
"I'm sure Rickshaw didn't intend to make any kind of offensive device," he ventured hopelessly.
"Who gives a damn what he intended? Where is the thing now?"
"I had a couple of servants put sandbags round it."
"Good idea. It's whoom, whoom, whoom."
It was a muffled sound from the corridor. The two wizards exchanged a meaningful glance. Whoom, 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 whoom. The bursar held his breath.
Blip, blip, blip.
The Arch-Chancellor peered at the hourglass on the mantelpiece.
"It's doing it every 5 minutes now," he said.
"And it's up to 3 shots, said the bursar. "I'll have to order some more sandbags."
He flicked through a heap of paper. A word caught his eye. Reality. He glanced at the handwriting that flowed across the page. It had a very small, cramped, deliberate look. Someone had told him that this was because Numbers Rictor had been an anal retentive. The bursar didn't know what that meant and hoped never to find out. Another word was measurement. His gaze drifted upwards, and took in the underlined title, Some Notes on the Objective Measurement of Reality. Over the page was a diagram. The bursar stared at it.
"Found anything?" said the Arch-Chancellor, without looking up.
The bursar shoved the paper up the sleeve of his robe.
"Nothing important," he said.
Down below, the surf boomed on the beach. And below the surface, the lobsters walked backwards along the deep, drowned streets. Victor threw another piece of driftwood onto the fire. It burned blue with salt.
"I don't understand her," he said. "Yesterday she was quite normal. Today it's all gone to her head."
"Bitches," said Gaspode sympathetically.
"Oh, I wouldn't go that far," said Victor. "She's just aloof."
"Loofs," said Gaspode.
"That's what intelligence does for your sex life," said Don't Call Me Mr. Thumpy. "Rabbits never have that sort of trouble. Go, so, thank you, do."
"You could try offering her a mouse," said the cat. "Present company accepted, of course," it added guiltily, trying to avoid Definitely Not Squeak's glare.
"Being intelligent hasn't done my social life any favours either," said Mr. Thumpy bitterly. "A week ago, no problems. Now suddenly I want to make conversation, and all they do is sit there wrinkling the noses at you. You feel a right idiot."
There was a strangulated quacking.
"The duck says, have you done anything about the book?" said Gaspode.
"I had a look at it when we broke for lunch," said Victor. There was another irritable quack.
"The duck says, yes,
"But what have you done about it?" said Gaspode.
"Look, I can't go all the way to Ankh-Morpork just like that," snapped Victor. "It takes hours. We film all day as it is."
"Ask for a day off," said Mr. Thumpy.
"No one asks for a day off in Holywood," said Victor. "I've been fired once, thank you."
"And he took you on again at more money," said Gaspode. "Funny that." He scratched an ear. "Tell him your contract says you can have a day off."
"I haven't got a contract, you know that. You work, you get paid, it's simple."
"Yeah," said Gaspode. Yeah. A verbal contract, it's simple. I like it."
Towards the end of the night, Detritus the Troll lurked awkwardly in the shadows by the back door of the Blue Lias. Strange passions had racked his body all day. Every time he'd shut his eyes, he kept seeing a figure shaped like a small hillock. He had to face up to it. Detritus was in love. Yes, he'd spent many years in Ankh-Morpork hitting people for money. Yes, it had been a friendless, brutalizing life, and a lonely one, too. He'd been resigned to an old age of bitter bachelorhood, and suddenly, now, Holywood was handing him a chance he'd never dreamed of. He'd been strictly brought up, and he could dimly remember the lecture he'd been given by his father when he was a young troll. If you saw a girl you liked, you didn't just rush at her. There were proper ways to go about things. He'd gone down to the beach and found a rock, but not any old rock. He'd searched carefully and found a large, sea-smoothed one with veins of pink and white quartz. Girls liked that sort of thing. Now he waited shyly for her to finish work. He tried to think of what he would say. No one had ever told him what to say. It wasn't as if he was a smart troll like Rock or Morry, who had a way with words. Basically, he'd never needed much of what you might call a vocabulary. He kicked despondently at the sand. What chance did he have with a smart lady like her? There was the thump of heavy feet and the door opened. The object of desire stepped out into the night and took a deep breath, which had the same effect on Detritus as an ice cube down the neck. He gave his rock a panicky look. It didn't seem anything like big enough now, when you saw the size of her. Maybe it was what you did with it that mattered. Well, this was it. They said you never forgot your first time. He wound up his arm with the rock in it and hit her squarely between the eyes. That's when it all started to go wrong. Tradition said that the girl, when she was able to focus again, and if the rock was of an acceptable standard, should immediately be amenable to whatever the troll suggested, i.e. a candle-lit human for two. Although, of course, all that sort of thing wasn't done anymore now, at least if there was any chance of being caught. She shouldn't narrow her eyes and catch him a ding across the ear that made his eyeballs rattle.
"You stupid troll," she shouted, as Detritus staggered around in a circle. "What you do that for? You think I unsophisticated girl off mountain? Why you not do it right?"
But,
Detritus began in terror at her rage.
"I'm not able to ask father permission to hit you, not know where he living."
Ruby drew herself up haughtily.
"All that old-fashioned stuff, very uncultured, no," she sniffed. "It's not the modern way. I'm not interested in any troll," she added. "That not up to date. A rock on the head may be quite sentimental," she went on, the certainty draining out of her voice as she surveyed the sentence ahead of her. "But diamonds are a girl's best friend."
She hesitated. That didn't sound right even to her. It certainly puzzled Detritus.
"What, you want I should knock my teeth out?" he said.
"Well, all right, not diamonds," Ruby conceded. "But they're proper modern ways now. You got to court a girl."
Detritus brightened.
"Ah, but I," he began.
"That's court, not caught," said Ruby wearily. "You got to...
She paused. She wasn't all that sure what you had to, but Ruby had spent some weeks in Holywood, and if Holywood did anything, it changed things. In Holywood, she'd plugged into a vast cross-species female Freemasonry she hadn't suspected existed, and she was learning fast. She'd talked at length to sympathetic human girls, and dwarfs. Even dwarfs had better courtship rituals, for God's sake. All dwarfs have beards, and wear many layers of clothing. Their courtships are largely concerned with finding out, in delicate and circumspect ways, what sex the other dwarf is. And what humans got up to
was amazing. Whereas all a female troll had to look forward to was a quick thump on the head, and the rest of her life subduing and cooking anything the male dragged back to the cave. Well, there were going to be changes. Next time Ruby went home, the Troll Mountains were going to receive their biggest shake-up since the last continental collision. In the meantime, she was going to start with her own life. She waved a massive hand in a vague way.
"You got to sing outside a girl's window," she said, and you've got to give her oogla."
"Oogla?"
"Yeah, pretty oogla."
Trolls have 5,400 words for rocks, and one for vegetation. Oogra means everything from moss to giant redwoods. The way trolls see it, if you can't eat it, it's not worth naming it. Detritus scratched his head.
"Why?" he said.
Ruby looked panicky for a moment. She also couldn't for the life of her imagine why the handing over of inedible vegetation was so important. But she wasn't about to admit it.
"Fancy you not knowing that," she said scathingly.
The sarcasm was lost on Detritus. Most things were.
"Right," he said. "I'm not so uncultured as you think," he added. "I bang up to date. You wait and see."
Hammering filled the air. Buildings were spreading backwards from the nameless main street into the dunes. No one owned any land in Holywood. If it was empty, you built on it. Dibbler had two offices now. There was one where he shouted at people, and a bigger one just outside it where people shouted at each other. Sol shouted at handlemen, handlemen shouted at alchemists, demons wandered over every flat surface and drowned in the coffee cups and shouted at one another. A couple of experimental green parrots shouted at themselves. People wearing odd bits of costume wandered in and just shouted. Silverfish shouted because he couldn't quite work out why he now had a desk in the outer office, even though he owned the studio. Gaspode sat stolidly by the door of the inner office. In the past 5 minutes he had attracted one half-hearted kick, a soggy biscuit, and a pat on the head. He reckoned he was ahead of the game, dog-wise. He was trying to listen to all the conversation at once. It was extremely instructive. For one thing, some of the people coming in and shouting were carrying bags of money.
"You what?"
The shout had come from the inner office. Gaspode cocked the other ear.
I want a day off, Mr. Dibbler," said Victor.
"A day off? You don't want to work?"
"Just for the day, Mr. Dibbler."
"But you don't think I'm going to go around paying people to have days off, do you? I'm not made of money, you know. It's not as if we make a profit, even. Hold a crossbow to my head, why don't you?"
Gaspode looked at the bags in front of Sol, who was furiously adding up piles of coins. He raised a cynical eyebrow. There was a pause.
"Oh, no," thought Gaspode. "The young idiot's forgetting his lines." "I don't want paying, Mr. Dibbler."
Gaspard relaxed.
"You don't want paying?"
"No, Mr. Dibbler."
"But you want a job when you get back, I suppose,"
said Dibbler sarcastically. Gaspard tensed. Victor had taken a lot of coaching.
"Well, I hope so, Mr. Dibbler. But I was thinking of going to see what untied alchemists had to offer."
There was a sound exactly like the sound of a chair back striking the wall. Gaspode grinned evilly. Another bag of money was dropped in front of Sol.
"Untied alchemists?"
"They really look as if they're making progress with soundies, Mr. Dibbler," said Victor meekly.
"But they're amateurs and crooks."
Gaspode frowned. He hadn't been able to coach Victor past this stage.
"Well, that's a relief, Mr. Dibbler."
"Why's that?"
"Well, it'd be dreadful if they were crooks and professional."
Gaspode nodded. "Nice one. Nice one." There was the sound of footsteps hurrying around a desk. When Dibbler spoke next, you could have sunk a well in his voice and sold it at $10 a barrel.
"Victor. Vic. Haven't I been like an uncle to you?"
Well, yes, thought Gaspode. He's like an uncle to most people here. That's because they're his nephews. He stopped listening, partly because Victor was going to get his day off, and was very likely going to get paid for it as well, but mainly because another dog had been led into the room. It was huge and glossy. Its coat shone like honey. Gaspode recognized it as purebred ram-top hunting dog. When it sat down beside him, it was as if a beautifully sleek racing yacht had slipped into a berth alongside a coal barge. He heard Sol say, "So that is Uncle's lightest idea, is it? What's it called?"
"Laddie," said the handler.
"How much was it?"
$60.
"For a dog? We're in the wrong business."
"It can do all kinds of tricks," the breeder said. "Bright as a button," he said. "Just what Mr. Dibbler is looking for."
"Well, tie it up there, and if that other mutt starts a fight, kick it out."
Gaspode gave Sol a long, thoughtful scrutiny. Then, when the attention was no longer on them, he sidled closer to the newcomer, looked it up and down, and spoke quietly out of the corner of his mouth.
"What you here for?" he said.
The dog gave him a look of handsome incomprehension.
"I mean, do you belong to someone, or what?" said Gaspode.
The dog whined softly. Gaspode tried basic canine, which is a combination of whines and sniffs.
"Hello," he ventured. "Anyone in there?"
The dog's tail thumped uncertainly.
"The grub here's ruddy awful," said Gaspode.
The dog raised its highly bred muzzle.
"What this place?"
it said.
"This is Hollywood," said Gaspode conversationally. "I'm Gaspode, named after the famous Gaspode, you know. Anything you want to know, you just..."
"All these two legs here. What's this place?"
Gaspode stared. At that moment, Dibbler's door opened. Victor emerged, coughing, at one end of a cigar.
"Great, great," said Dibbler, following him out. "Knew we could sort it out. Don't waste it, boy, don't waste it. They cost $1 a box." "Oh, I see you brought your little doggy."
"Woof," said Gaspode irritably. The other dog gave a short, sharp bark and sat up with obedient alertness radiating from every hair.
"Oh," said Dibbler, "and I see we've got our wonder dog."
Gaspode's apology for a tail twitched once or twice, then the truth dawned. He glared at the larger dog, opened his mouth to speak, caught himself just in time, and managed to turn it into a bark.
"I got the idea the other night when I saw your dog," said Dibbler. "I thought people like animals. Me, I like dogs. Good image, the dog. Saving lives, man's best friend, that kind of stuff."
Victor looked at Gaspode's furious expression.
"Gaspode's quite bright," he said.
"Oh, I expect you think he is," said Dibbler, "but you've just got to look at the two of them. On the one hand, there's this bright, alert, handsome animal, and on the other, there's this dust ball with a hangover. I mean, no contest, am I right?"
The wonder dog gave a brisk yap.
What's this place? Good boy, laddie."
Gaspode rolled his eyes.
"See what I mean?" said Dibbler. "Give him the right name, a bit of training, and a star is born."
He slapped Victor on the back again.
"Nice to see you, nice to see you. Drop in again any time, only not too frequently. Let's have lunch sometime. Now get out. Sol?"
"Coming, uncle."
Victor was suddenly alone, apart from the dogs and the room full of people. He took the cigar out of his mouth, spat on the glowing end, and carefully hid it behind a potted plant.
"The star is whelped," said a small, withering voice from behind.
"What's he say? Where's this place?"
"Don't look at me," said Victor. "Nothing to do with me."
"Will you just look at it? I mean, are we talking thicker or city here or what?"
sneered Gaspode.
"Good boy, laddie."
"Come on," said Victor. "I'm supposed to be on set in 5 minutes. Gaspode trailed after him, muttering under his horrible breath. Victor caught the occasional, "Old rug," and "man's best friend," and "bloody wonder, bloody dog." Finally, he couldn't stand it any longer.
"You're just jealous," he said. "What of an overgrown puppy with a single-figure IQ?"
sneered Gaspode.
"And a glossy coat, cold nose, and probably a pedigree as long as your arm."
"Well, as my arm," said Victor.
"Pedigree? Pedigree? What's a pedigree? It's just breeding."
I had a father too, you know, and two granddads, and four great-granddads, and many of them were the same dog even. So don't you tell me from no pedigree, said Gaspode.
He paused to cock a leg against one of the supports of the new Home of the Century of the Fruit Bat Moving Pictures sign. That was something else that puzzled Thomas Silverfish. He'd come in this morning, and the hand-painted sign saying Interesting and Instructive Films had gone, and had been replaced by this huge billboard. He was sitting back in the office with his head in his hands, trying to convince himself that it had been his idea.
"I'm the one holy wooed called," Gaspode muttered in a self-pitying voice. "I came all the way here, and then they chose that great airy thing. Probably it'll work for a plate of meat a day, too."
"Well, look, maybe you weren't called to Holywood to be a wonder dog," said Victor. "Maybe it's got something else in mind for you."
This is ridiculous, he thought. Why are we talking about it like this? A place hasn't got a mind. It can't call people to it.
Well, unless you count things like homesickness. But you can't be homesick for a place you've never been to before. It stands to reason. The last time people were here must have been thousands of years ago.
Gaspode sniffed at a wall.
"Did you tell Dibbler everything I told you?" he said.
"Yes, he was very upset when I mentioned about going to Untied Alchemists."
Gaspode sniggered.
"And you told him what I said about a verbal contract not being worth the paper it's printed on?"
"Yes. He said he didn't understand what I meant, but he gave me a cigar, and he said he'd pay for me and Ginger to go to Ankh-Morpork soon. He said he's got a really big picture planned."
"What is it?" said Gaspode suspiciously.
"He didn't say."
"Listen, lad," said Gaspode, "Dibbler's making a fortune. I counted it. There were $5,273.52 on Sol's desk, and you earned it. Well, you and Ginger did."
"Gosh!"
"Now, there's some new words I want you to learn," said Gaspode. "Think you can?"
"I hope so."
"Per cent age of the gross," said Gaspode. "There. Think you can remember it?"
"Per cent age of the gross," said Victor.
"Good lad."
"What does it mean?"
"Don't you worry about that," said Gaspode. "You just have to say it's what you want, okay? When the time's right."
"When will the time be right, then?" said Victor.
Gaspode grinned nastily.
"Oh, I reckon when Dibbler's just got a mouthful of food, it'd be favourite."
Holywood Hill bustled like an anthill. On the seaward side, Firwood Studios were making The Third Gnome. Microlithic Pictures, which was run almost entirely by the dwarfs, was hard at work on Gold Diggers of 1457, which was going to be followed by The Gold Rush. Floating Bladder Pictures was hard at work with Turkey Legs, and Borgles was packed out.
"Well, I don't know what it's called, but we're doing one about going to see a wizard. Something about following a yellow sick toad,"
a man in one half of a lion suit explained to a companion in the queue.
"No wizards in Holywood, I thought."
"Oh, this one's all right. He's not very good at wizarding."
"So, what's new?"
Sound. That was the problem. Alchemists toiled in sheds all over Holywood, screaming at parrots, pleading with minor birds, constructing intricate bottles to trap sound and bounce it around harmlessly until it was time for it to be let out. To the sporadic boom of octocellulose exploding was added the occasional sob of exhaustion or scream of agony as an enraged parrot mistook a careless thumb for a nut. The parrots weren't the success they'd hoped for. It was true that they could remember what they had heard and repeat it after a fashion, but there was no way to turn them off, and they were in the habit of ad-libbing other sounds they'd heard, or, Dibbler suspected, had been taught by mischievous handlemen. Thus, brief snatches of romantic dialogue would be punctuated with cries of,
"Wah! Show us your knickers!"
And Dibbler said he had no intention of making that kind of picture, at least at the moment. Sound! Whoever got sound first would rule Holywood, they said. People were flocking to the cliques now, but people were fickle. Colour was different. Colour was just a matter of breeding demons who could paint fast enough. It was sound that meant something new. In the meantime, there were stopgap measures. The dwarf studio had shunned the general practice of putting the dialogue on cards between scenes, and had invented subtitles, which worked fine provided the performers remembered not to step too far forward and knock over the letters. But if sound was missing, then the screen had to be filled from side to side with a feast for the eyes. The sound of hammering was always Holywood's background noise, but it redoubled now. The cities of the world were being built in Holywood. Untied alchemists started it, with a 1/10 size wood and canvas replica of the Great Pyramid of Tussaud. Soon the backlots sprouted whole streets in Ankh-Morpork, palaces from Pseudopolis, castles from the Hublands. In some cases the streets were painted on the back of the palaces, so that princes and peasants were separated by one thickness of painted sacking. Victor spent the rest of the morning working on a one-reeler. Ginger hardly said a word to him. Even after the obligatory kiss when he rescued her from whatever it was Morrie was supposed to be today. Whatever magic Holywood worked on them, it wasn't doing it today. He was glad to get away. Afterwards, he wandered across the backlot to watch them putting Laddie the Wonder Dog through his paces. There was no doubt, as the graceful shape streaked like an arrow over obstacles and grabbed a trainer by a well-padded arm, that here was a dog almost designed by nature for moving pictures. He even barked photogenically.
"And you know what he's saying?" said a disgruntled voice beside Victor. It was Gaspode, a picture of bow-legged misery.
"No, what?"
"Me, laddie, me, good boy, laddie," said Gaspode. "Makes you want to throw up, doesn't it?"
"Yes, but could you leap a 6-foot hurdle?" said Victor.
"That's intelligent, is it?" said Gaspode.
"I always walk around."
"What's that they're doing now?"
"Giving him his lunch, I think.
They call that lunch, do they?"
Victor watched Gaspode stroll over and peer into the dog's bowl. Laddie gave him a sideways look. Gaspode barked quietly. Laddie whined. Gaspode barked again. There was a lengthy exchange of yaps. Then Gaspode strolled back and sat down beside Victor.
"Watch this," he said.
Laddie took the food bowl in his mouth and turned it upside down.
"Disgusting stuff," said Gaspode. "All tubes and innards. I wouldn't give it to a dog, and I am one."
"You made him tip out his own dinner?" said Victor, horrified.
"Very obedient lad, I thought," said Gaspode, smugly.
"What a nasty thing to do."
"Oh, no. I give him some advice, too."
Laddie barked peremptorily at the people clustering around him. Victor heard them muttering.
"Dog don't eat his dinner," came Detritus's voice. "Dog go hungry."
"Don't be daft. Mr. Dibbler says he's worth more than we are."
"Perhaps it's not what he's used to. I mean, a posh dog like him and all is a bit yucky, isn't it?" "It's dog food. That what dogs are supposed to eat."
"Yeah, but is it wonder dog food? What are wonder dogs fed on?"
"Mr. Dibbler will feed you to him if there's any trouble."
All right, Detritus. Go round to Borgles. See what he's got. Not the stuff he gives to the usual customers, mind."
"That is the stuff he gives to the usual customers.
That's what I mean."
5 minutes later, Detritus trailed back, carrying about 9 pounds of raw steak. It was dumped in the dog bowl. The trainers looked at Laddie. Laddie cocked an eye towards Gaspode, who nodded almost imperceptibly. The big dog put 1 foot on one end of the steak, took the other end in his mouth and tore off a lump. Then he padded over the compound and dropped it respectfully in front of Gaspode, who gave it a long, calculating stare.
"Well, I dunno," he said at last. "Does that look like 10% to you, Victor?"
"You negotiated his dinner?" Gaspode's voice was muffled by meat.
"I reckon 10% is very fair. Very fair in the circumstances.
You know, you really are a son of a bitch," said Victor.
"Proud of it," said Gaspode, indistinctly. He bolted the last of the steak. "What shall we do now?"
"I'm supposed to get an early night. We're starting for Ankh very early tomorrow," said Victor, doubtfully.
"Still not made any progress with the book?"
"No."
"Let me have a look, then."
"Can you read?"
"Dunno. Never tried."
Victor looked around them. No one was paying him any attention. They never did. Once the handles stopped turning, no one bothered about performers. It was like being temporarily invisible. He sat down on a pile of lumber, opened the book randomly at an early page, and held it out in front of Gaspode's critical stare. Eventually the dog said,
"It's all got marks on it."
Victor sighed.
"That's writing," he said.
Gaspode squinted.
"What, all them little pictures?"
"Early writing was like that. People drew little pictures to represent ideas."
"So, if there's a lot of one picture,
It means it's an important idea. What? Well, yes, I suppose so.
Like the dead man?
Victor was lost.
The dead man on the beach?
No, the dead man on the pages, see? Everywhere there's the dead man.
Victor gave him an odd look and then turned the book around and peered at it.
Where? I don't see any dead men.
Gaspard snorted.
Look, all over the page, he said. It looks just like those tombs you get in old temples and stuff, you know, where they do this statue of the stiff lying on top of the tomb, with his arms crossed and holding his sword, dead noble.
Good grief, you're right. It does look sort of dead.
Probably all the writing's going on about what a great guy he was when he was alive, said Gaspard knowledgeably. You know, Slayer of Thousands stuff. Probably he left a lot of money for priests to say prayers and light candles and sacrifice goats and stuff. Used to be a lot of that sort of thing, you know. You get these guys whoring and drinking and carrying on regardless their whole life, and then when the old Grim Reaper starts sharpening his scythe, they suddenly becomes all pious and pays a lot of priests to give their soul a quick wash and brush up, and generally keep on telling the gods what a decent chap they was.
Gaspard, said Victor, levelly.
What?
You were a performing dog. How come you know all this stuff?
I ain't just a pretty face.
You aren't even a pretty face, Gaspard.
The little dog shrugged.
I've always had eyes and ears, he said. You'd be amazed the stuff you see and hear when you're a dog. I didn't know what any of it meant at the time, of course. Now I do.
Victor stared at the pages again. There certainly was a figure which, if you half closed your eyes, looked very much like a statue of a knight, with his hands resting on his sword.
It might not mean a man, he said. Pictographic writing doesn't work like that. It's all down to context, you see.
He racked his brains to think of some of the books he'd seen. For example, in the Agatean language, the signs for woman and slave, written down together, actually mean wife. He looked closely at the page. The dead man, or the sleeping man, or the standing man resting his hands on his sword, the figure was so stylized it was hard to be sure, seemed to appear beside another common picture. He ran his finger along the line of pictograms. See, he said. It could be the man figure is only part of a word. See? It's always to the right of this other picture, which looks a bit like a doorway or something, so it might really mean... He hesitated. Doorway man, he hazarded. He turned the book slightly.
Could be some old king, said Gaspard. Could mean something like, the man with the sword is imprisoned or something. Or maybe it means, watch out, there's a man with a sword behind the door.
Could mean anything, really.
Victor squinted at the book again.
It's funny, he said. It doesn't look dead, just not alive.
Waiting to be alive. A waiting man with a sword. Victor peered at the little man figure. It had hardly any features, but still managed to look vaguely familiar.
You know, he said, it looks just like my Uncle Osric.
Click, 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 click. The film spun to a standstill. There was a thunder of applause, a stamping of feet, and a barrage of empty-banged grain bags. In the very front row of the Odeon, the librarian stared up at the now empty screen. It was the fourth time that afternoon he'd watched Shadow of the Desert, because there's something about a 300-pound orangutan that doesn't encourage people to order it out of the pit between houses. A drift of peanut shells and screwed-up paper bags lay around his feet. The librarian loved the clicks. They spoke to something in his soul. He'd even started writing a story which he thought would make a very good moving picture. It was about a young ape who is abandoned in the big city and grows up being able to speak the language of humans. Everyone he showed it to said it was jolly good, often even before they'd read it. But something about this click was worrying him. He'd sat through it four times and he was still worried. He eased himself out of the three seats he was occupying and knuckled his way up the aisle and into the little room where Bizam was rewinding the film. Bizam looked up as the door opened.
"Get out," he began, and then grinned desperately and said, "Hello, sir. A pretty good click, eh? We'll be showing it again any minute now, and... What the hell are you do? You can't do that."
The librarian ripped the huge roll of film off the projector and pulled it through his leathery fingers, holding it up to the light. Bizam tried to snatch it back and got a palm in his chest that sat him firmly on the floor, where great coils of film piled up on top of him.
He watched in horror as the great ape grunted, grasped a piece of the film in both hands, and with two bites, edited it. Then the librarian picked him up, dusted him off, patted him on the head, thrust the great pile of unwound click into his helpless arms, and ambled swiftly out of the room with a few frames of film dangling from one paw. Bizam stared helplessly after him.
"You're banned," he shouted, when he judged the ape to be safely out of earshot. Then he looked down at the two severed ends.
Breaks in film weren't unusual. Bizam had spent many a flustered few minutes feverishly cutting and pasting, while the audience cheerfully stamped its feet and high-spiritedly threw peanuts, knives, and double-headed axes at the screen. He let the coils fall around him and reached for the scissors and glue. At least, he found after holding the two ends up to the lantern, the librarian hadn't taken a very interesting bit. Odd, that. Bizam wouldn't have put it past the ape to have taken a bit where the girl was definitely showing too much chest, or one of the fight scenes. But all he'd wanted was a piece that showed the sons galloping down from their mountain fastness, in single file, on identical camels.
"Dunno what he wanted that for," he muttered, taking the lid off the glue pot. "It just shows a lot of rocks."
Victor and Gaspode stood among the sand dunes near the beach. "That's where the driftwood hut is," said Victor, pointing, "and then if you look hard you can see there's a sort of road pointing straight towards the hill, but there's nothing on the hill but the old trees." Gaspode looked back at Holywood Bay.
"Funny it being circular," he said.
"I thought so," said Victor. "I heard once where there was this city that was so wicked that the gods turned it into a puddle of molten glass," said Gaspode, apropos of nothing. "And the only person who saw it happen was turned into a pillar of salt by day and a cheese shaker by night."
"Gosh, what had the people been doing?"
"Dunno, probably not much. Doesn't take much to annoy gods."
"Me, good boy. Good boy, laddie."
The dog came streaking over the dunes, a comet of gold and orange hair. It skidded to a halt in front of Gaspode, and then began to dance around excitedly, yapping.
"He's escaped, and he wants me to play with him," said Gaspode despondently. "Ridiculous, ain't it? Laddie, drop dead."
Laddie rolled over obediently, all four legs in the air.
"See, he understands every word I say," muttered Gaspode.
"He likes you," said Victor.
"Huh," sniffed Gaspode. "How are dogs ever going to amount to anything if they bounce around worshipping people just 'cause they've been given a meal? What's he want me to do with this?"
Laddie had dropped a stick in front of Gaspode, and was looking at him expectantly.
"He wants you to throw it," said Victor.
"What for?"
"So he can bring it back."
"What I don't understand,"
said Gaspode, as Victor picked up the stick and hurled it away, Laddie racing along underneath it,
"is how come we've descended from wolves. I mean, your average wolf, he's a bright bugger, know what I mean? Chock full of cunning and like that. We're talking grey paws racing over the trackless tundra is what I'm getting at."
Gaspode looked wistfully at the distant mountains.
"And suddenly, a handful of generations later, we've got Percy the pup here, with a cold nose, bright eyes, glossy coat, and the brains of a stunned herring."
"And you," said Victor.
End of side 8.